Welcome to the Sports Medicine Podcast, brought to you by the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology at Texas A&M University. At the Huffines Institute, we're always working to facilitate, apply, and bring you the most up-to-date coverage of the wide world that is sports medicine and human performance, all in a language you can understand and share with your friends. And now, here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Well, hello and welcome to the weekly edition of the podcast from the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance. I'm your host, Tim Lightfoot, and I'm so glad that you took the time to download us and that you're listening to us. We have another interesting person from the world of sports medicine with us. Today, coming to us via phone from Baltimore, Maryland, is Dr. Andrew Lincoln. He's the director of Sports Medicine Research Center for the MedStar Health Research Institute, and he's the program coordinator of the MedStar Sports Medicine Concussion Program. Welcome to the podcast, Andy.
Thank you. Very good to be here.
Well, we're so glad to have you on. Let me tell the audience a little bit about you and why we've got you on the podcast today, and we'll just jump into the conversation. Dr. Lincoln has a bachelor's degree in engineering science and mechanics from Virginia Tech, a master's from Louisiana Tech in biomedical engineering, and then a PhD in injury epidemiology from Johns Hopkins there in Baltimore. One of the reasons we have him online today is because of an article that he and colleagues published recently in the Medicine and Science and Sports and Exercise Journal. It just came out, I believe, in the March issue, called Risk and Causes of Death Among Former National Football League Players, 1986 to 2012. And so we're going to chat a bit about that and about some of the other things that he does. He currently coordinates the research activity for the Sports Science and Safety Committee of U.S. Lacrosse and the NFL Subcommittee on Cardiovascular Health. He has won several awards from the NCAA, as well as the O'Donohue Award from the American Orthopedic Society for Sports Medicine. So again, welcome to the podcast. And let's just jump off on this and on this article. And Andy, why did you guys decide to do this article?
So this is something that we've been thinking about for quite a while, working with Dr. Andy Tucker at the NFL Subcommittee for Cardiovascular Health that was formed back over 10 years ago, maybe 11 or 12 years ago, out of concern really for the increasing size of NFL players and the long-term effects that may be related to that increased size. So that's where this study idea was first originated, within that committee. And it's also a bit of a follow-up study to one that was done by the CDC using an earlier cohort of NFL players.
Now, there's been some concern that NFL players were at a higher risk for death, primarily because of a larger body mass index, because the players are so large. I mean, there's been some reports that have kind of sensationalized that a bit, hasn't there?
Yeah, it's interesting that the conventional wisdom seems to be that NFL players are destined for a short lifespan, that they're all going to die in their 50s. Not something that we had found in the previous literature with an older cohort of players. The game has changed quite a bit since the players of that era. You know, that was an era before the players were working out 11 and a half months a year. You know, they didn't have the incomes that they have now, and they weren't nearly the size that they are now. So a lot of those factors we thought played potentially better or worse for the population, so we wanted to explore and see how it worked with this group of players.
Now, in a lot of cases, we don't go really in-depth on the methods, but I want to take a few minutes and tell the audience about how you went about doing this, because there's also, I think there's been some cynicism amongst the population when anything comes out that has NFL associated with it, that sometimes they think maybe the NFL is not telling the whole story. And so I'd like for you to chat a little bit about how you actually came to the conclusions you came to, how you got this data and how you put it together, because it's really pretty impressive.
Yeah, well, we had a lot of help along the way, that's for sure. We started out with a cohort of over 11,000 players that we were provided individual player records from their player information office at the league. And then we did a lot of matching and a lot of time following up and identifying missing pieces of data for you know, again, what started out to be over 11,000 players, and we decided to limit it to players whose first year was between 1986 and 2012,
mm-hmm.
who have played one or more seasons in the league. So that was a little bit different than the previous research effort around this. What took us a long time was we couldn't find any recorded data on player rate. So we literally had to search. We ended up identifying on the order of 10,000 players after we excluded players for various reasons or missing data. But that involved a couple of trips to the Hall of Fame library in Canton, Ohio, to actually dig through media guides and identify pictures of players that we could not find online.
So this is not a trivial group, a sample. I mean, this is almost 10,000 players in this sample, so this is a big sample. And you guys also did something very interesting in that you matched the information, the player information, with the National Death Index to find out who had died and who not.
Right. So we were able to, with the National Death Index, they have an analysis program. It matches groups of individuals by 5-year age increments, by sex and by race,
mm-hmm.
and then looks at the risk of death and causes of death in each of those 5-year sex and race groupings or strata. So we were able to compare our group, weighted according to which strata they were in, to the general population.
And that was unique. That's one of the things that I read some of these studies with elite athletes, and actually you reference several of them here, and that's kind of the piece that a lot of them don't do, is where you guys actually did that and actually matched it with the National Death Index. It just, so out of that almost 10,000 player sample, about how many of those athletes had passed away?
So we had identified 227, so which was only 2% of this cohort that had passed.
Yeah, it was pretty interesting that y'all found that the there's so much discussion about concussion now and cognitive impairments, but in actuality, the three major causes of death that you saw were heart disease, violence, and transportation injuries.
Yeah, that's right. Now it's still a relatively young cohort. I think our median age was around 41 years of age.
Mm-hmm.
So, we've essentially got folks who may have retired in 2012, 2013, or, only in the league for a year at that point. So those are young men.
Right.
And even our oldest players, whose last year might have been in 1986. So they're still relatively young.
Yeah.
So we'd hope to continue to follow this group and see if the findings persist as they age.
Oh, and that'll be fascinating. Then you can also pick up some cognitive issues as well as you go.
Sure.
Yeah. So there were a couple, I won't say surprising findings, but there were certainly a couple findings that kind of went against what has been the popular idea of what happens to football players. And you want to share those findings?
Sure. So when we looked at the entire cohort and looking at deaths from all causes, we identified that the NFL cohort had a 54% lower risk of death than the general male population in match to the same age group.
Mm-hmm.
And then the biggest cause of death was cardiovascular disease. And specifically for that cause, NFL players even had a 35% lower risk to the general population.
Hmm.
And if we look at the top five causes, they were all significantly lower than our general population. So in addition to the ones you mentioned, the heart disease, violence, and transportation injuries, we have other injuries, and then cancer was the number five cause.
Hmm. So that really does argue against the popular perception that if you play football, you're going to be at a greater risk for death, especially in these age ranges.
It does, and when we shared this with one of the former players who was in the league for about 9 years, he said, this is really important for us as former players to understand, because there's a certain degree of fate that players have, and there's a certain belief that we know we're going to die young, and if that's the belief, then they may adopt behaviors, you know, riskier behaviors, thinking that they're going to die young anyway, which maybe... So what we're trying to do now is get the word out to them that they're not necessarily destined for that shorter lifespan.
Right. Now, you in the paper, you and your colleagues had talked about some reasons why this group may be relatively more healthy than the general population out there, one of which I think included something called the Healthy Worker Environment, or HWE.
Healthy Worker Effect.
Effect.
That's a term... that's broadly used to help us understand why people in the workforce are generally have longer lives and lower mortality rates than the general population. So just to get into the workforce and be in a productive job, you typically have a better health status, less disability, less sickness than folks who aren't able to obtain a job, right?
Right.
So with the NFL, it's that effect to an extreme. I mean, these folks are just amazing, super conditioned, and no doubt that that's what goes into part of what we're seeing here.
Yeah. Well, and that reflects, I think, so many of the folks' experience in sports medicine is that the people that we see on a daily basis are the elite athletes or the very well-fit athletes, and so it is puzzling to think that they may be more at risk for death earlier from things like cardiovascular disease and so forth, because they are so healthy at that time. They have to be.
Absolutely, they do have to be. And as part of having to be, one of the big things is almost none of them smoke at all. At least when we were looking in a similar study we did with active players, we only found one in over 500 who smoke tobacco. So if you take that out of the risk and all of the conditions and long-term effects associated with smoking, you know, it could be that in itself may explain a large amount of the lower rate that we saw.
Yeah. Now, I think probably unsurprisingly, you found in the players that had the highest BMIs, especially the linemen and so forth, there was a bit of an elevated risk there, but that's pretty similar to what the U.S. population has for that same BMI grouping, isn't it?
So one thing we weren't able to do with our comparison to the general population is actually compare like BMI to BMI, because we really don't have data when the general population passes away. We don't have, say, a height and weight on that birth certificate, or I'm sorry, the death certificate.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not able to calculate their BMIs. And you know, we didn't have it for the players either currently or at the time of death. So we used their last year of active playing in the league, and recognizing that it may have changed dramatically between their last year in the league and whenever it is now. So it's really a surrogate for that.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, yeah, the guys who were in the heaviest BMI group, so this was greater than 35 kilograms per meter squared, have at least a twofold increased risk of heart disease-related death than the general population. And that is probably our biggest concern going forward.
Yeah, we're aware that there are some programs out there, especially in the college age group, with some of these folks that don't go into the league, helping them figure out how to live a healthier lifestyle after they get out of college, so to drop weight and so forth. I think we interviewed a fellow by the name of Jeff Pottinger who's involved in that. And so that certainly has been a concern in both high school and college. And you spoke about that briefly as you talked about these linemen that carry a lot of weight at the beginning.
Yeah, for some of the linemen, they are just tremendously huge-boned, you know, huge-framed individuals. And that's pretty natural, but I think for a lot of the guys who are playing at the 310, 330 weight, it's really difficult for them to maintain that season after season. And it's not unusual. We've heard stories with some of these former players where, you know, they would just eat 7 meals a day in order to keep that weight on. And example, Matt Burke, the all-pro center for the Ravens, played around 310, 315, and he's down to about 240, and he looks like a totally different person.
Yeah.
There's several examples of linemen who have been successful in doing that, but it's not always easy for these guys because of dietary habits of eating huge portions and such a high caloric intake for so many years that when the activity level drops back down when they retire, that doesn't necessarily mean that their eating behaviors go with it.
Right. Now, if you had somebody come up to you on the street and say, you know, this is great, this study helps alleviate some of the current concerns of some of the NFL players, how would you think the average person out on the street, what value is this information for them?
Well, I think it does a couple things. It helps, again, with that conventional wisdom or that assumption that these players are all going to die young, and so behaviors can fit that lifestyle. And because these guys are so much in the public eye, that when one of them passes, whether it's heart disease or an act of violence or a car crash, it makes the papers, it makes the news oftentimes, and so we have a bit of a skewed perception of what their actual risk is, because we don't hear about a lot of those things with, you know, day-to-day folks in the general population. So it's really correcting that sense that, oh yeah, these guys are all dying so young.
Right. So you mentioned earlier that you guys hope to follow this cohort up in the future. What kind of time frame are you looking at? Are you looking at another 5 years or 10 years or this ongoing?
Well, we hope to keep it ongoing. We're working with the league to keep that funding going, but we may submit it, look for additional funding sources as well, because it is a really unique cohort. You know, it's also a group that actually got a high level of college education and insurance coverage. So that's somewhat unique as well, in addition to being very physically fit at a young adult age.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, you mentioned a topic that has come up over and over again on our podcast. From when we talk to scientists, when we ask them what their future plans are, they said, well, it all depends on the money.
It's a key factor. We were very fortunate to get league funding, and then they really just stepped out of the way. We had no restrictions from the league outside of their sponsorship. But, yeah, given that there's so much concern about the neurological-related deaths and other related deaths, that's certainly something that we would be interested in continuing to track. And we do have neurodegenerative causes of death as one of the causes that we were able to identify. And even that one, that specific cause, had a lower risk of death than the general population, which I'm sure is surprising to a lot of people in the public.
Well, it will certainly be interesting to watch for your future work. Certainly, football is very popular in America, and we certainly are very interested in making sure that the players maintain their health. And none of us want to see them have adverse health effects because of their participation. I think whether they're in junior high school all the way up to the pro levels, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So, Andy, I want to thank you so much for your time today. We're getting the sign that we're running low on time here, and so, if you had one take-home message that you want people to remember from this podcast, what would that take-home message be?
Well, I think it's the importance of losing weight and getting to a reasonable size for the bigger players.
Mm-hmm.
That's potentially a modifiable characteristic, and right now it looks like those guys really are at elevated risk for cardiovascular death, and we want to intercede on that. That doesn't always get the headlines, but that is the biggest cause of death in this cohort, just as in the general population. So just like it's a big issue for many of us to maintain, you know, good eating habits and exercise, that applies to this group as well.
Great. Well, thank you again. And I want to thank all of you that are listening for taking the time to download it and listen to us today. Regular listeners of the podcast will know this is the time of the podcast when we have the podcast question of the week. And so here with our podcast question of the week is Carlos.
How big was the cohort of players Dr. Lincoln and his team studied?
Thank you for the question, Carlos. Great question. Remember that if you're the first one to email us the correct answer at huffines@tamu.edu, you'll win one of our nifty podcast T-shirts. I think we're on the fourth edition of that T-shirt. So, you know, if you've won one in the past and you want to complete your collection, just go ahead and send us the email. Never think you're too late. Sometimes we've been known to send out more than one T-shirt. So get those emails in to us. Once again, thank you, Dr. Lincoln, for taking the time to be with us today.
You bet.
And again, we thank you all for being with us this week as we have talked another interesting person in the world of sports medicine and human performance. Join us next week, and we'll have someone else with us in the podcast. And until then, we hope you stay active and healthy.
The executive producer of the Sports Medicine Podcast is Carlos Guevara. This podcast is licensed by the Huffines Institute at Texas A&M under an attribution and no derivatives Creative Commons license. You can share it as much as you want, and you can talk or blog about it all you want. Just don't change it or charge money for it. This podcast is made possible by support from the Omar Smith family and the Sidney and J.L. Huffines family. Our music was composed, performed, and graciously provided by Dave Zeltner Productions, your source for quality music and music production since 1992. Find them at www.davidzeltner.com. Our opening and closing credits were provided by John Miles Productions at johnmilesproductions.com. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffines@tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.